Hello, and welcome to the Buddhist Studies Podcast. We're here today with Dr. Constance Kasser. Dr. Constance Kasser is an assistant professor of religious studies at Lawrence University in Wisconsin, where she teaches courses on Buddhist thought and Asian religious traditions. She is joining the BSO family to teach a course called BSO 104, Tibetan Buddhism. And we're so delighted to have you with us today. Can I call you Connie? That's what I know to call you as a personal friend.
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kate.
So part of what I like to do whenever I'm talking to a scholar of Buddhism is just get the story of, you know, how did you end up in this position? What got you interested in studying Buddhism in this way?
Yeah. Well, you know, the other day I was listening to the podcast that you did with Karin Myers, and I was laughing because I was just thinking about how similar my own trajectory is to hers, and probably how similar a lot of folks of our generation of Buddhist studies is they're similar in a lot of ways. I like to say that, so I teach, Lawrence University, where I teach, is a small liberal arts school. And I like to say that my path to where I am is like an advertisement for the liberal arts. I did my undergrad at Smith College, a small women's college in Massachusetts, and liberal arts school. I thought I was going to major in biology and become a biomedical engineer and work for a pharmaceutical company. That was my whole big plan. And then I met Jay Garfield, who taught the course on the Bodhicharya Avatara, and he's a philosophy professor at Smith. And I happened to take a class with him. He was teaching a course on skepticism, and it was one of these things. I had to take something, you know, outside of biology. I wasn't really loving my biology classes at the time. And I took this philosophy course because it fit into my schedule. And so we're reading the Greek skeptics, and then we're reading some Western philosophers. And then at the end of the semester, we read some stuff by this Indian guy named Chandrakirti. And we started reading about Chandrakirti's theories of selflessness. And I was really intrigued by that. And right around that same time, I think it was the next semester or the next year, there was a Tibetan Buddhist monk. His name was Tashi Tsering, and he was visiting at Smith and also I think teaching at Hampshire College down the road. Just for a semester, he had come from the Central Institute of Higher Tibetan Studies in Sarnath, India. And he was teaching a course at Smith. And I just thought, oh, I liked that Indian philosopher guy that I learned about in my skepticism class. And how cool would it be to learn about Buddhist philosophy from a Buddhist monk? So I took this class on Chandrakirti's Madhyamaka Avatara, and this kind of famous 7th century philosophical text. I didn't understand anything. I understood maybe like 10% of what happened in that class, but the 10% that I did understand just totally blew my mind, and I was really excited about it. And then Jay Garfield that winter was taking a group of students, like he does almost every year, to Sarnath, to the Central Institute of Higher Tibetan Studies, to do a 3 or 4 week long intensive course learning about Tibetan history, Tibetan philosophy, Buddhism more broadly. And I went on this trip. I don't know, we'd been there for 3 or 4 days. And I remember sitting around after dinner, and Jay just looked at me and he was like, "So Connie, what do you think of it here?" And my eyes were just bulging out of my head. And I was like, I have to spend more time here. I have to, like 3 or 4 weeks, however long we were spending in India, wasn't going to be enough. And he just kind of nodded his head and he said, "Okay, you could do that. You could come back here to Sarnath after you graduate, but you have to learn Tibetan." And I was like, okay. And then I went out the next day. I found a Tibetan student at the university and I was like, "Will you teach me the alphabet?" And he was like, "Yeah, sure." And then he sat down. I started learning the alphabet. And then came back to Smith, changed my major to philosophy, started learning Tibetan. And then after I graduated, I went back to Sarnath, and I studied with Tashi Tsering, this monk who had been visiting India. And he very patiently sat with me pretty much every day for about a year, or an academic year, so about 9 months. And we read through the Madhyamakavatara, this same text that he had taught when he came to Smith. And we read a couple of commentaries. And we read them in Tibetan, very, very slowly. And I'm still just very grateful for Tashi Tsering Law's patience with me as we muddled through these texts. But that was when I learned that not only was Buddhist philosophy just really interesting and really fascinating, but also in Tibetan philosophy, there were all these different ways of interpreting these Indian texts. And I learned that there were all of these debates that were happening in Tibet and among Tibetan philosophers. And I just thought that was really, really fascinating. And so then I went on to grad school at Emory University shortly after that. And that was really what kind of set me down this path. So, you know, just like Karin, you know, Jay Garfield is really the impetus for me getting into Buddhist studies, and this program that he leads in Sarnath at the Central Institute for Higher Tibetan Studies. That's really an influential part of my journey.
Yeah, it sounds like so many of like the elements of what gets folks into Buddhism are in there. And just like the transformative experience of, again, studying, you know, with, you know, lineage trained scholars. What a great opportunity that Smith brought in someone like that to study with. And, you know, of course, Jay Garfield is a thread that connects lots of sort of people in the extended BSO family. And actually, hopefully I'm not, you know, spilling the beans here on the podcast, but we're in talks with Jay to teach a course on the Madhyamakavatara for the course.
Oh,
which
that's
I was
great.
Always pleased about, because, you know, I sell BSO students really highly. I love our students because they're so highly motivated. They want to be here. They want to learn. They ask fantastic questions. And I'm sure Jay was like, sure, sure, sure. Of course you'd say that. But the fact that he wants to teach another course after the one he taught, he was like, all the things you said about BSO students were true. I said, yeah, they're the best.
That's great. That's awesome. And, that's really good.
You know, I learned so much from his Bodhicaryavatara course. And look forward to learning the Madhyamakavatara, which, again, even in English translation is so confusing.
It is a hard, hard text.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just, there are so many just really interesting ways of making sense of what Chandrakirti says in that text. And even for as dense and complicated as it is, it's also really beautiful, and it leaves a lot of space open for interpretation.
Yeah, and I think that experience that, you know, I certainly would share, and perhaps a lot of listeners would share, is that early experience of learning about Buddhism, you do have that sense of like, I don't understand all of this. I don't even know what it would mean to understand all of this, but the parts I do understand have so sort of radically made me question what I thought coming to this, and have just, you get a glimpse of this other way of looking at and experiencing the world that just, you know, makes you want to dive in. And so that's great to hear that you've been able to dive in, especially because a lot of your research activity has dealt with Madhyamaka in general as well, specifically with the work of Gorampa Sonam Senge. Who was Gorampa Sonam Senge, and what sort of attracted you to do research about him?
Oh yeah, Gorampa's a great guy. So I discovered Gorampa. I started learning about Gorampa during this year that I spent after college with Tashi Tsering, reading through commentaries of the Madhyamakavatara. So when I had been at Smith, I took this seminar with Jay. He had been finishing a translation by Tsongkhapa, the scholar in the Gelug tradition. And when I went to Sarnath and I was studying with Tashi Tsering, he's part of the Sakya tradition, so a rival tradition in Tibetan Buddhism. And Gorampa is basically the most important philosopher in the sort of mainstream Sakya tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. So maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here. I talk about this a little bit in the course, but there are different sects of Tibetan Buddhism. There are different schools of Tibetan Buddhism and all these really interesting philosophical debates that happen. So what has come to be sort of the dominant philosophical school, or at least it was the dominant philosophical school for a long time, was the Gelug tradition. This is the tradition that the Dalai Lama belongs to. The Sakya tradition is equally sophisticated philosophically, but kind of got relegated to minority status during some historical developments in Tibet, but I also get into some of the details of that in the course. But Gurampa lived in the 15th century, and he was just this really skilled philosopher, he was a renowned practitioner. He wrote at least 13 volumes worth of texts. So not 13 texts, but 13 volumes worth of texts. So just, it's a really prolific author. But one of his favorite philosophical opponents was Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Gelug school. So Tsongkhapa lived just before Gurampa did. And because of some political developments that happened when the Gelug sect kind of came into power around the time of the fifth Dalai Lama, the fifth Dalai Lama worked to consolidate power in Tibet and really asserted Gelug dominance in Tibet. And as a result of that, he ordered that philosophical texts that were critical of the Gelug tradition or of Tsongkhapa, he ordered that those should be destroyed or suppressed or hidden away or what have you. So Gurampa was kind of studied in secret by the Sakya tradition off in Eastern Tibet, where the central Tibetan government didn't necessarily have as much control. And it wasn't until about the 1920s, sometime between 1920 and 1925, there was a monk named Jamgyel Rinpoche who decided that he was going to collect the extant collected works of Gurampa. So he went to the 13th Dalai Lama, the previous Dalai Lama, and he asked for his permission. And the 13th Dalai Lama, at this point, the Gelug sect was, you know, firmly in control. Rival philosophical views were not so much of a threat anymore. So the 13th Dalai Lama said, sure, you can collect these. And so he went around Eastern Tibet and collected all of these manuscripts of Gurampa's writings. And he collected these 13 volumes worth of writings. And they were reprinted in Derge at the big publishing house there. So he's just historically this really interesting figure because his texts were suppressed for such a long time, but they were considered so important that they were still preserved. But it's not until, you know, within the last 100 years that his work has been able to be distributed widely and studied. So just historically, that's part of what I think is really interesting about Gurampa. Philosophically, I think there's all kinds of just really interesting things about the ways that he argues. He's kind of fun to read because he can sometimes get really snarky, and his criticisms of Tsongkhapa especially are pretty harsh by like 15th century Tibetan monastic standards. There's a story that at one point Tsongkhapa had a vision of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, and Gurampa in this very kind of measured, calculated way at one point says, you know, maybe Tsongkhapa thought he saw Manjushri, but maybe it was actually a demon who was visiting him and telling him the wrong things. So let me explain what the right
fighting words.
So there's, there's a lot. And it's, so he's fun to read, in that way, just because he's kind of snarky, but he's also really, really smart philosophically.
Yeah. And I love the idea of, there's a colleague of mine here at the University of Wyoming who teaches a banned books course. And I love the idea that this is sort of like a banned book for a certain period of Tibetan history.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, I think that's, you know, something that folks who are relatively new to the study of Buddhism can be quite surprising that there were these kind of you know, fierce disputes over how to interpret the Buddha's teachings. My sort of read on Tibetan Buddhism as a whole is just this attempt to interpret the flood that they get, because Tibet gets Buddhism kind of very quickly relative to, you know, the long history that it had had in India. And so they get, you know, 1,000 years of Buddhist history, and they're forced to be like, what does this mean? And, you know, there's no necessarily right answer, right? So people disagree, and people think that this is really important to get the Buddha's teachings correct. And so these kind of disputes just are a reflection of the fact that this is considered a really important thing to get right. Are there any sort of major differences that we could talk about? Although, actually, first I'd like to back up and just say that both of these writers are writing about Madhyamaka, this kind of school of thinking in Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, to someone who may be coming to the podcast without very much knowledge of what any of that means. What is it that they are sort of writing about, talking about? Why does this matter at all?
Yeah, thank you for kind of bringing the conversation back. I know, Kate, you and I have had a lot of conversations, and I think sometimes I get really excited about this stuff, so it's easy to just kind of start running with things. But understanding what Madhyamaka is really important in the context of understanding what's happening in Tibetan philosophy as a whole. So over the course of Buddhism, you know, if we think about Shakyamuni Buddha, who lived in India 2,500, 2,600 years ago, a lot has changed and a lot has developed in Buddhism. So I think just to start, even to take things back, even a step, to step back a little bit further, even though the word we use, Buddhism, is kind of a complicated word, because if we look at different Buddhist traditions, if you look today at what monks are doing in Thailand and what lay people are doing in Japan and what nuns are doing in Nepal, they look totally different. There's different languages, different scriptures, different practices, different philosophical views. And all of these traditions can trace their origins back to Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha. But all of these branches have developed in tandem with culture and politics and language and other religions and other cultural ideas. And so things have really developed in a lot of different and interesting ways. So when we use the word Buddhism, it's kind of a nice, convenient sort of umbrella term, but we have to understand that there are different Buddhist traditions.
And when Europeans we now call Buddhism in different, it was hundreds of years before they realized that what people were doing in Japan was in some sense the same thing as what people in Sri Lanka were doing. Because it looked different that it wasn't until much later that people started reading texts or getting to know things in a more historical way that there was any reason to say, okay, this is the same religion. And so when we bring this frame of like Buddhism, you know, there is this kind of unity that we're imposing on something that may look very, very different. Always a good point to make.
Yeah. Yeah. Any of those isms, you know, we have to be careful of whatever, you know, fill in the blank ism, what we're talking about. But so the Madhyamaka tradition is a philosophical development within Buddhism. And Madhyamaka, you know, there are a few ways we can kind of talk about the origins of Madhyamaka or the development of Madhyamaka, but probably the most important philosopher when we're talking about the beginnings of the Madhyamaka philosophical tradition was this guy named Nagarjuna, who lived in the 2nd century in India. And he wrote about this theory of emptiness, which probably folks who are listening, if you know like a tiny bit about Buddhism, you've probably heard this word emptiness. And emptiness is kind of a confusing word, because we hear the word empty or emptiness, and it brings to mind this idea of nothingness. And so a lot of times people will hear the word emptiness in Buddhism and they'll be like, oh yeah, nothing exists. Nothing matters, or, you know, but that's not really what Madhyamaka is. That's not really what emptiness is. So Madhyamaka is a Sanskrit word, that means, it basically means the middle way. So, you know, this kind of goes back to the life story of the Buddha, when, you know, he was living this life of extravagance in the palace, and then he was living this life of extreme asceticism. And then he said, no, I have to follow a middle way. So Madhyamaka sees itself as kind of the philosophical development of the middle way. And this theory of emptiness, what it really means is that nothing exists independently. Nothing exists with an essence. You know, so, you know, just to give, you know, a basic example, the desk that my computer is sitting on now, if I try to analyze this desk and I try to find, you know, the essence of the desk, Madhyamaka philosophers will say, well, you can't really find it, right? The desk is just, you know, some legs and a top, and it's made out of some particle board, I think, you know, and some paint. But there's no like specific point in the desk that I could point to and say, this is the essence of the desk. This is the deskness of the desk. And so when Madhyamaka philosophers are talking about emptiness, that's a very basic example, but that's kind of what they're getting at. They're saying the table is empty of any kind of essence, any kind of inherent deskness. In the same way, a person is also empty of any inherent self or Atman. So if folks who are listening have studied a little bit of Buddhism before, they're probably familiar with the Buddhist theory of selflessness, Anatman or Anatta. And so Madhyamaka is really kind of extending that idea. Now, the flip side of that is, because nothing exists independently on its own, that also means that everything exists interdependently in an interconnected sort of way. So the desk only exists as the desk because it exists in dependence on other things, non-desk things. And we'll get more into some of the details of some of that in the course. I think in module 3, when we talk a little bit more about philosophy, but that's kind of maybe basic Madhyamaka 101 before digging into any of the details of that.
Yes. And that's always, you know, it's, there are many things that are challenging about teaching Buddhism, as I'm sure you've experienced. And so whenever I try to teach about this idea of emptiness, you know, one resource, and I'll post this in the comments of the, or in the description of the podcast, but there's a Thich Nhat Hanh essay called The Fullness of Emptiness, that, mm-hmm. you know, instead That's, of, you know, yep. thinking of this as nothingness, when you have this view that everything's interconnected, there's no independent essence of everything, you have to recognize the fact that everything is dependent on everything else and everything is connected. This past year during COVID, I was teaching my students outside. So whenever it was, I say to my students, if it's over 45 degrees, bring a coat, we're going to be outside. You know, just trying to minimize risk because I was teaching in person. And so you could just like pick up a leaf and say, you know, what's in this leaf? You know, the sun, the air, the rain, the squirrel that buried the acorn. And then my students would point out, you know, that's, I'm not good at knowing different kinds of trees. And so... okay, this is a cottonwood, whatever sort of seed goes into this. But, you know, everything that has to exist for this leaf to exist is in some way connected to and is in the leaf, right? So seeing the leaf as empty is not seeing the leaf, but just recognizing everything that is connected to the leaf. And so, you know, some folks, again, want to jump from that to this sort of nihilism, nothing exists, nothing matters. But instead, it forces you to say everything matters. You know, every being matters. Everyone's suffering matters.
Exactly. And I'm glad you brought up Thich Nhat Hanh, because I also use him to explain emptiness to my students. Sometimes we read in my classes, we'll read the Heart Sutra, which is, you know, this very important text that talks about emptiness, but it's only like a page and a half long, and it's super dense, and it's, you know, it expresses the idea of emptiness, but in this very, very complicated way, if you've never experienced it before, where, you know, form is empty, emptiness is form, form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, you know, like it goes on and, you know, it's trying to unpack this idea of emptiness, but in this very, very concise way. And Thich Nhat Hanh has this really lovely, very short commentary on the Heart Sutra called The Heart of Understanding. And so we read the Heart Sutra. I give students a couple days to just really puzzle over that. And they're like, I don't understand. I can't make sense of this. And then we read Thich Nhat Hanh's commentary. And he starts out in that commentary, The Heart of Understanding, which I think is similar to what he writes in The Fullness of Emptiness. And he says, if you look at this sheet of paper, you'll see a cloud floating in this sheet of paper. And then he goes on to explain that, you know, the paper comes from a tree and the tree comes from, you know, the ground, and the tree couldn't grow without the rain, and the rain comes from the cloud. So there's a cloud in the sheet of paper. And then he goes on to expand from that, you know, and when students read that and they encounter emptiness from the other side, from the side of interdependence, or Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing, it's a whole lot easier to grasp and a whole lot easier to wrap your head around, like, oh, we're all connected. And my happiness is wrapped up in your happiness, and your suffering is connected to my suffering. And actually, if we're following the Buddhist path, you know, it's not enough for me to just get rid of my suffering, because we're connected. And so I also have to work to alleviate your suffering and everyone else's suffering. And that's where the bodhisattva idea kind of comes into play.
Yes. And so, as you said, you will sort of delve into this even more in this third module. And, you know, we're giving sort of simplified explanations of emptiness, but the reason that Tibetans in particular wrote volumes and volumes and volumes about this is working out what this means, and particularly how you can construe what emptiness is, what that means for, you know, various sort of philosophical approaches to the Dharma. How do you approach this? Is emptiness something that you need from the beginning? Is emptiness something that you reach an understanding of but then pass beyond? Or is that the end goal? You know, how do you, there's lots of different ways of interpreting this. And to the extent that you feel able, and maybe this is, you know, very complicated, how does, you know, the difference that Gorampa, you know, approaches versus somebody like Tsongkhapa, even just giving us a taste of, you know, maybe different ways of approaching this complicated idea?
Yeah, it's a very complicated idea. It's so complicated, in fact, that I wrote a book about it. I've got a book that'll be out at some point in the future. Wisdom Publications is putting it out. It's called Accounting for Awakened Awareness. And it's kind of an unpacking and an explanation and analysis of some of Gorampa's Madhyamaka writings. But just kind of very briefly, if we think about how the Madhyamaka tradition made its way to Tibet, so there was Nagarjuna, who lived in the second century, and he had this, a handful of people in India wrote commentaries on Nagarjuna's writings. Nagarjuna wrote this book called the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. The Jay Garfield translates it as the Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way. And a few hundred years later, in the seventh century, Chandrakirti wrote the Madhyamaka Avatara, the entry into the middle way, entry into Madhyamaka, engaging with Madhyamaka. There's different ways to translate that text. And that was, in a certain sense, kind of a commentary on and an explanation of some of Nagarjuna's writings. And these texts, along with some other Madhyamaka texts, made their way into Tibet. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about the Tibetan reception of Indian philosophical texts is everything that the Tibetan writers are writing about, even though they're coming to pretty different conclusions about certain kinds of philosophical points is they all have to ground their analyses in things that Chandrakirti wrote, in things that Nagarjuna wrote, in things that the Buddha said that were recorded. So in Buddhist philosophy, you can never disagree with what someone who was authoritative said. You know, in Western philosophy, it's okay to be like, oh, well, actually, I think Descartes was wrong, and let me tell you why. You can't do that in Buddhist philosophy. No Buddhist philosopher can say, well, actually, Nagarjuna was mistaken when he wrote about emptiness. Because as soon as you do that, then it's like, okay, well, then you're not a Buddhist anymore. You're not part of the tradition. So it's this interesting, like, I like to think about it kind of like a game of chess. Like, there are certain rules and there are certain moves that you're allowed to make and certain moves that you're not allowed to make. But the same as, like, if you watch a really skilled chess player, you know, they can work really skillfully and be really creative within the confines of those rules. And so that's what we see in these Tibetan debates, is people who are playing by the rules. They're saying, okay, I understand this is what Chandrakirti said, this is what Nagarjuna said, but let me take this and kind of pick it apart and analyze it in this totally new and creative way that's totally different than what this other Tibetan interpreter is saying. So what I think is, and so Gorampa wrote a handful of Madhyamaka texts. We have three Madhyamaka texts that are complete. There's one kind of incomplete text that we have. But of his three complete texts, one, which I'm working on a translation of right now, it's this massive encyclopedic text. He calls it the synopsis of Madhyamaka. It's not really a synopsis, it's massive. It's like, so this huge kind of tome that draws on all of these different Tibetan thinkers and Indian thinkers, and it goes through all of these difficult points in Madhyamaka thought and different ways of thinking about emptiness. But what I think really is kind of the key point that kind of distinguishes Gorampa's philosophy from, say, Tsongkhapa's, is how do you realize emptiness? How do you understand emptiness? So this idea of, you know, we can talk about emptiness and interdependence, but how do you actually see the emptiness of, say, a leaf? You know, and that starts to get really complicated.
I'm definitely not there myself, and, you know, working on it.
Yeah. Well, and that's the goal, right? Like, that's, if we could see emptiness directly, we would all be Buddhas, you know, and we wouldn't have to be studying and listening to podcasts and taking courses. You know, we just directly experience emptiness and see things as they really are. But so, you know, it kind of comes down to, how do you realize emptiness? And so Gorampa has some interesting ideas about sort of the process you have to go through to get to that point. And really what he says is, you know, you have to do philosophy. You have to understand certain philosophical arguments to get you to emptiness. But the actual realization of emptiness, actually being able to see emptiness directly, experience emptiness directly, is something that completely transcends conceptual thought. And it's kind of funny to think about, because Gorampa goes to great lengths to say a realization of emptiness is beyond language and concepts. But then he spills all this ink, you know, trying to talk about what that process involves. So he's using a lot of words and language, but then saying, you know, well, the actual realization is beyond words and language. So I like to compare it to riding a bike. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you've never ridden a bike before, you could sit down and you could study and you could learn all about the principles of physics. You could learn about angular velocity and understand how, you know, the wheels have to be spinning at a certain rotation in order to keep you upright, and you have to turn the pedals, and here's how you shift and here's how you brake. But until you actually get on a bike and practice, you can't actually say that you know how to ride a bike. And so there's a certain level of experiential knowledge that you have to get through practice. And that's kind of similar to what Gurampa is saying, is the realization of emptiness. It's something that we could talk about. I could, you know, I could teach somebody about how to ride a bike, you know, but until they actually get on the bike and do it for themselves, they're not going to actually know how to ride a bike.
And that raises such an interesting question for, you know, what it is that we're doing here. Because this is a question that I get a lot. You know, sometimes my students or, you know, folks I encounter will say, okay, if the realization of emptiness, or perhaps the realization of awakening or nirvana, or, you know, whatever state you're trying to reach, is this non-conceptual, wordless thing that, you know, can't be conceptualized, why are we studying in this way? You know, what is the point of doing all of this philosophy? What's the point of spilling all this ink? And then straining our eyes to read all of these kinds of things.
Yeah. And this is, you know, this is actually a criticism of Gurampa that some of his Geluk opponents throw at him, you know, and they basically say, well, you know, like, yeah, why practice philosophy if the realization is, you know, totally non-conceptual, totally beyond concepts? You know, and this, the answer to this question, I say this to my students and it drives them crazy all the time, but it kind of depends on who you ask. You know, thinking about all these different Buddhist traditions that exist, they all have different answers to that particular question. I think kind of channeling Gurampa, if I wanted to kind of stay in that lane, what Gurampa would say is, you know, the practice depends on the philosophy. And you have to have that philosophical grounding, that philosophical basis before you can practice. So you know, Gurampa kind of follows a kind of a standard Tibetan way of framing the practice of Buddhism, where he talks about shilam jebu, so the basis, the path, and the result. And so you have to get a firm basis. You have to have a firm grounding, and that's kind of the philosophical underpinning. So that's the basis, the ji, and then the lam, the path. That's kind of the cultivation of ethics, and the things that you know, you have to do in order to cultivate compassion, cultivate merit, work on generating wisdom based on this kind of philosophical understanding of how the world works. And then once you've gone through that process and you followed the path, then you get to this result, which is this direct, non-conceptual, non-dual experience of emptiness.
Yes, and that the sort of notion of the path that we find everywhere in Buddhism, and that, you know, so the Visuddhimagga is the course that Maria Haim taught for us. You know, the path of purification is the literal translation of that by Buddhaghosa. And taking seriously that path notion, right? So we have this sort of state that you're trying to reach, you know, of awakening, of a direct insight into emptiness. But then the question of how you get there is where I think different Buddhist thinkers get really innovative, as you say, and where the difference occurs. Because people will largely agree, yeah, we're in the state of ordinary suffering. Yeah, the goal is over here. But then the question of how do you actually get there, right? Because it's not a moment... I was about to say it's not a question of just snapping your fingers and getting there, but then like perhaps some Buddhists would suggest otherwise. Any sort of position you can have, there's some, often the case, there's some Buddhist thinker who has explored it very, very deeply. And that these questions are ones that are being worked out in the tradition themselves. You know, that's also another thing that I like to talk about with students, is that it's not the case that we are studying people who like all agreed and had it all figured out. Like this is something that were live questions, and that's why these debates got started, right? Because people thought it mattered and people had different ways of working out how this seemingly impossible transformation of our experience of reality from ordinary suffering to awakening, how was that possible?
Yeah. And you know, and that's something that, you know, that's not just in the past, right? That's something that people who study Buddhism are still actively trying to wrestle with and figure out now. You know, I mean, this is even people who study Buddhist philosophy who are writing and thinking about this stuff in English. You know, we have the American Philosophical Association and the American Academy of Religion and all of these conferences where like we go and we actually talk about that. You know, Kate, you and I were just talking about at the most recent meeting of the American Academy of Religion, there was a whole panel. You know, there were, I don't know what, like 8 scholars who were all just trying to unpack one verse or 2 verses from the Bodhicaryavatara. You know, so this is, and everybody had a totally different take on it. So, I mean, when we talk about Buddhist philosophy, I get really excited about 15th century Buddhist philosophy because I really like Gorampa and I really like these debates, but this is an ongoing thing. You know, there's not a point where it's like, well, okay, we're done. We don't have to worry about that problem anymore. Which is part of what I think is really exciting and really fascinating. And I would argue that the kind of work that we're doing, people who study Buddhist philosophy, you know, in the, just for the sake of clarity, in the English speaking world in the 21st century, I don't think it's all that different than what Tibetan philosophers were doing in the 15th century. And it's not all that different than what Indian philosophers were doing or Chinese philosophers were doing centuries before that. This is all a continuation of how do we make sense of these really complex and varied and vast teachings that came out of India, and how do we wrestle with them and make them applicable to our own lives, whether we're practicing Buddhism or not. Like the philosophical ideas that are in these writings can be applied to our own lives in all different sorts of ways.
Yeah, and there's an interesting question there, right, is, you know, what do we do with the kind of methods that we have available to us? And hitherto we've talked mostly about philosophy, but also in unpacking that philosophy, you say, okay, in order to understand Gorampa's philosophical thought, you also have to understand something of the political and historical nature of what was happening in Tibet in the 15th century, but then also the time of the Great Fifth, and then at the time of the 13th Dalai Lama, and the ways that philosophy is never sort of just this entirely separate realm of philosophy. And so the question I'd like to bring in is, what do you think is the relevance of the study of the history of Buddhism, and you know, perhaps the history of Tibetan Buddhism in particular, to these same kind of questions of how do we live our lives now in a way that is informed by, you know, wisdom, compassion, awakening, a sense of interconnection?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, and I think understanding the broader historical and cultural context of these traditions that we're studying, it's essential. And you can't really just take these philosophical ideas and pluck them out of, I mean, people try, right? But like, it's not as effective. You can't really just pluck them out of their cultural context and work with them purely on their own terms. I mean, history and politics and philosophy and religion are deeply, deeply intertwined in Tibet, but not just in Tibet, right? Like we see this everywhere. I mean, you look at the U.S. today and you can't really make sense of the current political landscape in the U.S. without understanding something about evangelical Christianity, because that's so deeply tied into the government, you know? You can't really understand what's happening in the history of Western philosophy unless you understand something about Galileo and his trial by the Catholic Church, right? Because that shaped the course of Western philosophy. And so I think it's the same thing in Tibetan Buddhism, in Buddhism more broadly. You really have to understand these deep connections between historical developments and political developments, if you really want to understand what's happening in terms of religious practices, religious beliefs, the philosophical ideas that are coming out of that. You know, if we look at the history of Buddhism in Tibet, one of the reasons why Tibetan Buddhism has developed in the ways that it has to do with the fact that, like you mentioned before, it came to Tibet pretty quickly after it had a long time to develop in India, a long time to develop in China. And then all of a sudden, just boom, it came in from China, it came in from India. And Tibetans were like, okay, wait, these are two very different traditions. Like, what do we do with this? And so that's a lot of what you see happening philosophically in Tibetan Buddhism, is kind of wrestling with these very different traditions and these very different ideas that came into contact with each other around the same time. And the pre-existing religious traditions that happened in Tibet, and the relationships between Tibetan rulers and the Mongol Khans, and relationships between the Qing dynasty and Tibet. Like, all of these things are intertwined. And it, you know, the same way that you know, Gorampa would say you have to have a firm basis in the philosophy before you can engage in the practice and then get to the realization. I think if you really want to understand how Tibetan philosophy works, Tibetan Buddhist philosophy works, you have to have a firm basis in a grounding in at least some of the historical developments and the political developments.
Yeah, I liked your analogy of the chess game earlier, that there are certain sort of rules that govern what the game is, right? There's a certain sort of field on which the game is played. There's certain moves that you can make and certain moves you can't make, right? If you're playing soccer, you can't use your hands. But, you know, if you're playing volleyball, you can't use your feet. And that understanding sort of how those rules are formed, which is often a matter not just of philosophy, but it's a matter of history, it's a matter of culture, it's a matter of sociology, can allow you to better understand, okay, who's making these moves within what context and what do they mean? And, you know, how are they being shaped? And just as a side point, it's not the case that I think that Tibetan Buddhists in the past were constrained by rules and that we live in this totally free mode today, because we are just as governed by our own right. rules. And in fact, often those rules are invisible to us because we take them for granted. We're like fish in water, and we don't realize what the water is because it's all around us. That's part of why I think that the study of the humanities, the liberal arts of other cultures in general is very important, because we become more aware of our own sort of rules that are governing us. That's a different conversation. But that you can kind of, yeah, get a better sense of what is the thing that anyone is bringing to any conversation, and what are the things that are shaping that?
Yeah. And I think it's easy for us, you know, in sitting in North America, speaking English in our, you know, academic context, to look back at, say, you know, 15th century Tibetan Buddhism and say, okay, these were the constraints, these were the rules, these were the influences. But it's much harder, but I also think really important to also turn that lens on ourselves and to really think about, okay, well, what's motivating me here? And why am I paying attention to this source and not to that source, you know? And even if the things are like, you know, well, how am I going to get promotion and tenure if I focus on studying this book as opposed to that book? I mean, we have a lot of rules that we have to
so
play by.
So many rules in modern academia, so many rules that shape all of us. And it's also, you know, mm-hmm. one of the things that I think is a sort of underrated here, that's the word I'm looking for, sense of why it's important to study history, is that when we study history, we know that things change. And often we are finding ourselves trying to, again, do what you said before, is make these things applicable to our own lives, which is necessarily a very different kind of life than you could live in 15th century Tibet, for instance. And so the continual question of a lot of people interested in or practicing Buddhism in today's world is, okay, what if this is relevant? What if this is necessary? What if this might be different? So for instance, you know, there's been a lot of thought on, you know, gender and sexuality, that we live in a very different sort of cultural context right now. Or how might Buddhism speak to pressing issues that affect us right now, like climate change or structural racism, things that aren't necessarily on the Buddha's, you know, dashboard because they were not problems that affected him at that time. And in some sense, for me, studying history and realizing the kind of ever-changing nature of how the teachings are interpreted, in some ways makes me more aware of how things were done in the past, which I think is important, but also aware of that things have changed and might continue to change in a certain way. How does that, this sort of grounding in history, affect your sense of how the Dharma might be sort of interpreted, experienced, practiced today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point. And when we think about the ways that the Dharma is interpreted, right? I mean, even like, this is where we get, language trips us up, because we say, you know, the Dharma. Well, okay, you know, there was what the Buddha taught, which we don't even know what language the Buddha spoke. So we only have a close approximation of what the Buddha taught, right? Because it wasn't written down for the first time until after the Buddha died. So everything that we have, when we're talking about Buddhism, is interpretation of some sort, whether it's translation or a commentary. Everything is a certain kind of interpretation. And, you know, I think so thinking about that, and also thinking about this Madhyamaka idea of impermanent or interdependence, right? The other thing that kind of goes along with that is that nothing is permanent, nothing stays the same. And so interpretations of the Dharma are always changing based on different contexts. And so I think, you know, I said before, it's we can't, or it's maybe irresponsible to just pluck, you know, teachings and try to apply them without any kind of understanding of historical context. But if we can understand kind of where these teachings are coming from, if we can have an appreciation for the broader cultural and historical developments of certain ideas, or the context in which certain ideas developed, we can have more of an understanding and appreciation of those ideas. And then based on that kind of broader historical knowledge, we can apply teachings to our own lives. So like Shantideva, I've got Shantideva on the brain because I'm going to be teaching a course on the Bodhicaryavatara at Lawrence in the spring.
I just picked my copy up off my desk. I always have it handy. Bodhicaryavatara. Read it if you haven't gotten a chance.
Yeah.
You take one thing away from this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great book. Also read Gorapa when I make his stuff more available. You know, but like Shantideva has a lot of wisdom in the Bodhicaryavatara. There are also things he says, right? Like he specifically says in the Bodhicaryavatara, the Dharma should not be taught to women. You know, he says that. And I mean, we're a couple of women sitting here talking about this stuff, right? Like we make our livings, you know, in part by teaching other people about the history and the philosophy of Buddhism. So, you know, there are certain things that it's like, well, do we take everything that Shantideva wrote at face value? You know, and some people might argue, yes. You know, there might be some people who say, yeah, no, we should take everything that he says as at his word. But I obviously don't think that. But there are certain elements of Shantideva's writings that I think can and should be applied to our own lives. There are a couple of things I wrote for Lion's Roar that are taking certain aspects of Shantideva and Shantideva's writings and applying them to issues of racism, issues of you know, police brutality in the United States. And so I think there's a lot that we can do to apply these writings to our own contexts, but we have to understand the context that they were coming from in order to do that in a responsible and useful way.
Yeah, part of what I think is often just useful in reading anything in general, but reading stuff about Buddhism in particular, is just really slowing down. And in some ways, the study of history forces you to slow down in the same way that, say, if you're going to read Shantideva, it's not that long. You could read it in an afternoon, but you could also, you know, as was done at the American Academy of Religion conference, spent 2 hours talking about two verses. And you could do that for every verse. Mm-hmm. you know, and then start over informed by all of your interpretations of each verse the previous time and never get to the end of it. This is a wonderful thing that I've picked up from Maria Haim's work is, you know, the idea that the Buddha's speech is infinitely meaningful, right? You never reach the end of how meaningful it is. And that this was an interpretive framework that Buddhists used to interpret the Buddhist teaching, that you would never get to the end of it. And so I like to bring that sensibility to my reading of Buddhist texts because, yeah, just that process of slowing down and really considering it.
Yeah. And recognizing that, you know, not to get too philosophical, but, you know, Madhyamaka thinkers think about the relationship between an object and a subject. You know, I am the perceiver and then I perceive these things. And there are interesting ways that Buddhist philosophers talk about the relationships between subject and object. But basically what they say is that they coexist together. You can't have a subject without an object or an object without a subject. And I think if we apply that same sort of idea to reading Buddhist texts, one of the things that's really important is our relationship to or our perception of the text that we're reading. And so like the Bodhicaryavatara, I mean, I first read that text in maybe 2003, 2004. And, you know, I probably read it like at least once a year, whether I'm teaching it or referencing it or something. And every time I pick it up, I see something new. I learn something new, even if I'm reading the same verses over and over again, because I'm different and I relate to them in a different way. And my understanding of them is constantly changing, which I think is a really, really beautiful thing about Buddhist philosophy.
Yeah. And this sort of encounter with the object, then also shaping the subject, you know, and just the sort of way that we are sort of tied in with our encounter to whatever object that we're having. And maybe in the case of this course, the object is the past, trying to understand the history of Tibetan Buddhism on its own terms, to the extent that we can, because again, you know, we're always tied in with that perception as a way of not falling into the trap of allowing ourselves to do what I think a lot of us do on many occasions, which is project what we want to see on the objects that we encounter, right? And that's always, you know, an ever-present danger when encountering Buddhist traditions is to make them what you want them to be.
Right. And this came up, I think in your conversations with Jay Garfield on the podcast, you know, when like people will look at Buddhist philosophy who have a training in Western philosophy and they'll say, oh, that's just, you know, virtue ethics or whatever it might be, or that's just analytic philosophy or whatever it might be. And that's harmful. Because that's not actually seeing things for what they are.
Right? Yeah, and particularly when, you know, it plays into present dynamics, right? You know, one dynamic that is unfortunately too common in Western philosophy is that Asian philosophy is all just sort of mysticism, and at best it sort of approximates Western philosophy. And of course that's a harmful discourse. And similarly, you know, there's many ways to construe the history of Tibet that makes it fit into pre-existing political narratives of, oh, Tibet was this, you know, horrible place where people were, you know, enslaved and oppressed and it was terrible. Or on the flip side, that Tibet was this paradise where everything was perfect all the time and people just skipped around happily practicing the Dharma. And, you know, what I think people will get in this 104 Tibetan Buddhism class is a picture of Tibet as, you know, a human place filled with human people that doesn't easily slot into any of our narratives of something that you could just put in, you know, a couple of sentences.
Yeah, I mean, and it's messy, it's complicated, because it's, you know, full of humans. Humans are messy and complicated, and things that humans do are messy and complicated, and they can't be put into these neat little, this happened here and this was how people, you know. And yeah, I think your examples are great. Like, most people have one of two conceptions of Tibet, that it was this, you know, feudal sort of serfdom where, you know, people were, you know, I don't want to say enslaved, but, you know, in this sort of like oppressed sort of situation, toiling on the land, or that it was this, you know, this Shangri-La, you know, this mystical kind of place full of just like happy spiritual people. And it's no, there were people, and they were complicated, and there were different kinds of people, and they were all motivated by different things, and still are. And I think that's a really important thing to understand.
Yes, and that's always certainly the goal, to remember that in some fundamental ways, we are just like the people of the past in this goal of interpreting the teachings and applying them to our own lives and trying to live our best, you know, life with and for others. And we're different because of different historical causes and circumstances. And, you know, understanding those differences can allow some of those similarities to shine through a bit more, right? If we have this sort of static mm-hmm. picture of the past, all of a sudden those people start to look like people in a museum rather than people that we might actually have a productive exchange with. And so, you know, part of this, you know, idea of presenting this sort of messy, complicated historical picture is, of course, in tension with the fact that in a four-week course like BSO 104, you get essentially a relatively limited time to approach, you know, the entire history of Tibetan Buddhism. How do you approach the goal of teaching this? You know, you as our intrepid instructor, I handed you this impossible problem. And, you know, there's no one way to teach a course like this. But what are the kind of ideas, principles that you brought to how you organized the course?
Yeah. So you know, I gave a lot of thought to how to organize this course, because there are so many ways to approach this. And so, you know, ultimately what I kind of came down to in terms of the ways that this course is organized. So we've got these four modules. So module one is really focusing on the historical developments of Buddhism in Tibet. So in module one, we get a little bit into some of the politics and some of the broader historical context, but I'm a philosopher. I'm not a historian. We're not doing a comprehensive history of Tibet. But we spend in the first module, we do a quick kind of religious overview of what's going on with Buddhism in Tibet from the 8th century up to the present day, which is a lot of ground to cover in 90 minutes of lectures. But just kind of laying some of that historical groundwork to get a sense of, yeah, what was the broader context in which Tibetan Buddhism became Tibetan Buddhism? And then in the second module, we get into a little more of the detail of some of these different sects that developed. So even, you know, so Buddhism can be carved up into all these different Buddhist traditions. Tibetan Buddhism can be carved up into different Tibetan Buddhist traditions. And these are connected to some of the political and historical developments. They're also connected to different sorts of philosophical ideas. So in module two, we really get into some of these philosophical developments, looking at some of the important figures in the different major traditions of Tibetan Buddhism. And again, this is a lot to cover in just a 90-minute module. So we kind of do the greatest hits of the different schools of Tibetan Buddhism.
That's often what I sort of emphasize to students of my own, but then also in a BSO course like this, is that almost what we're giving you is more frameworks for understanding, and that
exactly.
that you can then take those approaches to further study. And that is, in fact, the goal, right? Because no, certainly no four-week course, no 400-week course would exhaust kind of everything that you could learn and study. But where we're hoping to, where I'm hoping to take people is from a sense of like, there's so much to do, I have no idea where to even start, to saying, okay, now I at least have some sort of frameworks, approaches, ways of thinking about this that can kind of guide me moving forward.
Right, right. Yeah, and so that's kind of how I'm trying to frame these. So, you know, students will come through this course and they'll understand, you know, something about, oh, okay, like, here's why the Dalai Lama is important, and here's why Milarepa is important to the Kagyu school, and, you know, just to have some kind of understanding of some of these ideas. And then, you know, hopefully students who are so inclined can then dig into, there's so much literature on Tibetan Buddhism that's out there, and there's so much fascinating stuff to read. And, you know, even just the reading list for the course, I was like struggling so much to fit the reading list into, you know, a reasonable size appropriate to the course. But there's a lot out there.
Mm-hmm. More and more every day. And one of the other things that I'll link to in the show notes is, I don't know if you follow High Peaks Pure Earth, but every year they put out a Tibet and the Himalayas like reading list of some of the best things that have been published in the past year. And I essentially took that list and was, you know, just popped over, you know, they include links for where to get stuff. And it was, you know, amazing how much research is going on. And they give like nice little synopses of things or why you should care. So, you know, it's like, oh, you know, this is up my alley. You know, maybe this one more to the bottom of the reading list. An endless amount of wonderful things to read and study.
It's great things. And so if I can just kind of talk a little bit about the other half of the course. So those are the first two modules, look at the history and the development of the different schools. And then module three gets into more of the philosophy. The stuff that I like to kind of nerd out about a little bit. So we'll talk about things like emptiness in a little more detail, and some of the debates around emptiness and why that's important. We'll look at compassion. We'll talk a little bit about Tantra. Tantra is a huge part of Tibetan Buddhism. That's like, that could be its own course all on its own.
And will be. Yes.
Oh, okay, great. That's fantastic. I might take that course. So so we'll touch on that a little bit. And then the fourth module will be more focused on practices. So, you know, we've got the history and the culture and the philosophy, and then looking at practices, because a lot of Tibetan Buddhism is grounded in what people actually do. You know, I read a lot of texts because that's what I get excited about. But, you know, most Tibetan Buddhists don't sit around and study philosophy intensively. Most people who practice Tibetan Buddhism are doing stuff. You know, they're going out and they're performing rituals, or they're, you know, going on pilgrimage. That's something you know a lot about, Kate. That's what we'll do kind of in module four. So my approach with this course is not so much to give a sort of chronological overview of Tibetan Buddhism, but more of a way of kind of looking at it from four different angles. That's kind of my hope with this course. And so giving students some insight into the different ways that Tibetan Buddhism as a whole, which is this big, complicated, messy thing, can be approached.
Yeah, and I was really, you know, excited to see the syllabus, just because, you know, whenever working with BSO has been incredible, because I basically get to curate my like list of dream professors and dream classes. But there's always part of my mind that's like, how would I teach this class? And when I was thinking about how to teach Tibetan Buddhism, which I did actually just do this semester, I was like, I guess I'd probably approach it chronologically, because as a sort of more history-based person, that's sort of my default. And then I was like, how would I do this? And then I saw that you have this more like thematic approach of taping different perspectives at this sort of broader phenomenon. I was like, that's a much better way to do it. I think that it's going to help students, again, you know, sort of make comparisons and think of things in these kind of buckets. And then, you know, because, again, so many ways that you could teach a class like this.
I was posting about this course on my Facebook page, just saying, hey, you know, here's this thing I'm doing on Tibetan Buddhism. And a handful of people, including one like very senior
I know
scholar,
who you're talking about. You know,
he posted and he was like, oh, can I see the syllabus for how do you teach that course? I always have a hard time teaching Tibetan Buddhism. And it's, you know, we all kind of have different approaches to this, which I think is a really interesting sort
of
thing.
Yeah, and I don't think it's problematic we mention his name, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah, probably not. I don't know.
It's George Dreyfus, who's the sound of two hands clapping is a thing that I teach in my Tibetan Buddhism class because it's this wonderful experience. He was the first essentially Westerner to get a geshe degree in Tibetan Buddhist monasteries in exile. And this involves, you know, over 20 years of intensive study, practicing debate. And he has this book where he relates his experience. So you get this kind of personal memoir flavor, but also he's, you know, so trained in Tibetan Buddhist Gelugpa philosophy in this instance that you get a lot of that as well. But then also the culture of memorization, the culture of sort of monastic discipline. What were people eating? What are the kinds of friends that he made?
It's such a
reminder that even so when he was like, oh, how do you teach this? It's like, okay, yeah. Even someone like that I would consider like, oh, that's, you know, someone that I very much look up to. And I met him as an undergrad, actually.
Yeah.
He came to speak at my undergrad institution, and I got to sort of shake his hand and be like, wow, I want to be like you someday. But even if even he doesn't know how to teach a Tibetan Buddhism course, then...
Right. That's testament to the fact that it's hard to teach, or everybody has a different approach, but the sound of two hands clapping is a fantastic
book. And I'll link to that as well. That was actually really, my really first kind of scholarly book on Tibetan Buddhism. So it just holds such a special place in my heart.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. There's so much literature out there. The one thing that I, was, you know, as I've been putting this course together, you know, there's so much that I have to skip over in this course. And one issue with the way that I have set up this course, that I want to kind of flag in the podcast and also, you know, I'll mention it in the lectures for the course, but, you know, so much of the information that we have, especially the historical information that we have or the philosophical information that we have from Tibetan Buddhism, is stuff that was written by men. And it was written by men, preserved by men, usually by monastics or by rulers, right? So people who had the power and the money and the resources and the time and the education to write things down and preserve them. And so who gets left out of that story are lay people a lot of times, like ordinary folks who either didn't have the education or didn't have the time to sit around and write books about what they were doing. And women who, you know, even if they were educated, didn't necessarily have the resources to produce and have preserved their writings. So I was really happy to see that there's a course on Buddhism and women that's coming out soon, because that's one thing that I've just, you know, I'm limited in the amount of time that I have in this course. And just in terms of the ways that I framed it, I just want to flag that, like, I'm leaving out a whole lot in this presentation of Tibetan Buddhism.
Yes, and that course will be taught by Jue Liang, who is an old grad school friend of mine, and this is a central research focus of hers. And so I too am really looking forward to that class and just thinking through again these issues, right, of how do we approach trying to learn about Buddhism and women when the historical record is so tilted in favor of those who had the resources and the cultural capital to be able to write and have their texts preserved. You know, and
yeah, it's an important thing to keep in mind.
And so before we go, and thank you so much for giving us this kind of overview of 104 and just how to think about how do you approach the subject of Tibetan Buddhism. I did want to pass along a question that we got on one of the Facebook pages talking about this course. And, you know, often I'm responding to Facebook comments myself, which is, you know, always a dangerous game to play, particularly when it is philosophical questions, which, you know, as someone who considers myself more of a history gal, I thought this was like a really interesting one. It's from Rohit Parikh. It says, is enlightenment a goal, or is, quote, having a goal, end quote, itself an impediment to being enlightened? And he references a journal article that he's one of the co-authors of, and I'll post a link to that as well. It's open access, which is really nice. The Buddha versus Pauper, When to Live in the Journal of Buddhist Ethics, volume 27, which just came out. And a couple of people responded in the comments, including myself. But I'm interested in hearing your take. And of course, the answer is it's complicated. Different people will disagree. But just, you know, interested in hearing your kind of flash take on that question.
So the question is enlightenment the goal?
Is enlightenment a goal? Okay. Or is having a goal itself an impediment to being enlightened?
So this is a question that students ask all the time, you know, when we're talking about, you know, the causes of suffering and how desire is one of the causes of suffering that keeps us trapped in this cycle of rebirth. And, you know, every term I get a student who asks something along the lines of, you know, well, then if you're desiring to get out of suffering, isn't that bad? And I always answer that question with, you know, the parable of the raft that that we see in and I can't remember the name of the sutta off the top of my head, but it comes from this Buddhist sutta or sutra, you know, one of the disciples asks the Buddha this same sort of question, and the Buddha responds with this story where he says, you know, there's a man who is trying to get from one side of a river to the other. And so he builds a raft and he uses the raft to get across the river. And then he picks up the raft and keeps carrying it with him through the forest. And the Buddha asks his disciple, you know, do you think that was wise? And his disciple says, no, he should have put the raft down when he was done. That was dumb for him to just keep carrying it with him. And the Buddha says, that's what, you know, you should do the same thing with my teachings. Use them for as long as it's useful for you. But at a certain point you have to, you know, put them down, so to speak. So, you know, maybe my answer to that question is kind of a non-answer, but, you know, I think, again, there are different ways of thinking about enlightenment or awakening or realization or the results. You know, it gets talked about in all different sorts of ways. And depending on how you approach it philosophically, you know, some philosophers say we're all already enlightened and we just need to realize that. You know, the metaphor is kind of like polishing a mirror, cleaning the dust off of a mirror. The mirror already reflects things. You just have to get rid of the crap that's on top of it. And other philosophers say, no, enlightenment is something that you have to cultivate. And so the metaphor for that is it's like planting a seed, and like there's that potential there, but you have to nurture it. You have to water it. You have to give it sunlight. You have to, you know, do all the things in order for the seed to grow into or become the thing that it has the potential to be. So that's maybe a non-answer to that question, because it
depends. The Buddha was not unfamiliar with a non-answer to a question. So never comparing ourselves to that. But yeah, thinking about these useful metaphors that Buddhists themselves are throwing around too, because again, we're all in the same boat of trying to come to terms with these traditions. and these ideas and what they mean for us. But I wanted to thank you so much for joining us today. It's been wonderful talking with you, hearing about your experience and background, and also what we can expect in this Tibetan Buddhism course. So again, thank you so much. Any last words?
Just thanks so much for having me. And I'm really looking forward to this course. I'm really, really excited to meet the students who are going to take the course.
I think you're really going to love them. We have the best students. And so with that, I'll sign off. So tune in next time to the Buddhist Studies podcast. We'll see you later. Bye.